This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Read all about it. Books about Islam, Osama bin Laden, and dusty academic tomes about Western civilization are flying off bookshelves and onto bestseller lists. It's not just books for grown-ups. In this hour, books about Islam written especially for children, hot sellers and hot-button issues. The September 11 tragedy has upset all Americans, but is uniquely unsettling for children. Parents must now explain to their kids what has happened and why, while they're still trying to make sense of it for themselves. Some parents and teachers are turning to bookstores and libraries for help. Brenda Bowen is Executive Vice President and Publisher for Simon & Schuster's Children's Publishing. She's spearheading a new initiative, Find Comfort in Books, Read Together. I asked her about the impact of September 11th on children's publishing and how the industry is responding.
Our strand of publishing doesn't rely so much on publicity, and a lot of our authors put down their pens and illustrators put down their pencils and just couldn't face going back to work. And in fact, a lot of us publishers also felt, what's the point? What is the point? And just a few days after September 11th, a group of us gathered in a room and said, what can we do? And there were a lot of different responses. One was to publish books about Islam and about Muslim Americans. Other people wanted to create a book that was a testament to the World Trade Center. But then we all lighted on the idea that to spend time reading together, to find comfort in books, was an important thing. So we put together a little grassroots campaign, Find Comfort in Books, Read Together, and we've been working with that slogan and trying to get it out to people.
That's great, and I'm sure people can take comfort in that. But in advance of new projects that are getting off the ground now, what is selling? Give us a sense of what people have been picking up in the bookstores since September 11th for children.
It's interesting because my adult colleagues at Simon & Schuster are saying that books are very hard to sell right now. We're finding that books are not so hard to sell right now because I think in a time of confusion and trouble, people do turn to books for children, for information. A lot of atlases have been selling for comfort and succor. A lot of books about grief have been selling. For escape, books like, of course, Harry Potter or Captain Underpants have been selling. Curiously, we had a biography of George W. Bush by Beatrice Gormley, which before September 11th had sold about 30,000 copies. We're now up to almost 200,000 copies on that title.
Wow. So that's moving. How does that compare with biographies of other famous Americans?
Well, that's a pretty extraordinary number if you're not Washington or Lincoln. And one of the reasons I think that it's selling particularly well is that we included Bush's address to the joint session of Congress that was about 11 days after the event. We have the full text of that, so it's current. Plus, it's a biography of a person who is thrust onto an international stage from semi-obscurity.
And that's the speech where he asked children to send in a dollar each for Afghan children, didn't he?
Yeah, I think that came a little later, but I know that schools all over the country rose to that challenge and took a dollar in. My daughter did. And I said, what's it for? Thinking it was for the World Trade Center victims because we live in New York. And she said, it's for the poor people in Afghanistan.
Brenda, what trends are you looking for now in children's literature coming up in this post-September 11th world? Do you expect there to be more interest in world cultures, in religions?
I think there might be. I think, though, it will be interesting to see how our authors and illustrators, always very creative thinkers, respond, whether they're going to be doing books that are darker or books that are funnier to escape or books that are more politically aware. I think it'll be interesting to see. I know that all of them are going to play it out in their writing somehow. So I think over the next, 2 to 3 years, we're going to see some very interesting diversions from more traditional literature. And I think, as you say, books that take a more global aspect and think of us Americans as players on a world stage rather than just in our own insulated country, I think those books for adults and children will really come to the fore.
Compare books for adults and children to us in response to crisis, not just September 11th, I guess, but in general. Are there differences in the way they tend to go? Do adults go more for escapism or more to dig into the subject, or are children's books more escapist or more on subject?
Yeah, I think at the beginning, the adult publishers can rush into press books that are very topical. so right away we've seen on the marketplace books about bin Laden and books about Afghanistan and books about germ warfare rush to market. In the children's world, I think we tend to take a longer view because our books are on the shelves for years and years. And I've been given several proposals about immediate responses to September 11th, and I'm not sure that that's the right approach for children. I think it needs to sort of steep for a while in the brains of the creators and then come out in whatever way it will.
So where does this event fall in the longer arc of children's literature? Is children's literature headed more toward the Harry Potter-style fantasy, or what are the great overarching themes or path of evolution you see in children's books?
You know, it's hard to say for me right now because we're right in it. But
we'll look back even before this, the September 11th, let's say, Brenda.
Well, if you think about books during World War II or Vietnam or Korea, there were a lot of patriotic books, and actually that is a current trend that we're seeing. Books about the flag, books about America are selling particularly well. And there may be more books in the future that extol the virtues of America while also trying to put it into a more global perspective. But as to the trend that will come out, it's hard to say. In some ways, children's books are immune because children themselves are not involved directly in the conflicts. If you think about books that were published during the Depression, they're much sunnier and brighter if they were written in the 30s than books that are written in the 90s or the 2000s about the historical event, the Depression. So sometimes as we're in the event, the books are, as you say, escapist. As we move farther from the event, they dig deeper into what was actually going on in the pain of the period.
It's a fascinating relationship between we adults and the children that we try to educate through books.
Yeah, exactly.
Brenda Bowen is Executive Vice President and Publisher for Simon & Schuster's Children's Publishing. She spoke to me earlier from Rome. We're talking about children's books that explore Islam. What do you want your children to understand about Islam and the Muslim world? Is your family finding comfort these days in reading together? You can join our conversation this evening at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining me now from Honolulu, Hawaii, is James Rumford. James Rumford wrote and illustrated the new book, Traveling Man, The Journey of Ibn Battuta. And in the days following September 11th, he wrote a short story called Last Tuesday. Welcome, James Rumford.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Tom.
Let us place you. Where are you in Hawaii right now?
I'm just, I don't know, about a mile from Waikiki.
And we're not.
And you're not, and it's a lovely day.
Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Your
new book, Traveling Man, was reviewed very favorably last weekend in the New York Times Book Review, and they said something interesting that yours and a couple of other books that touch on Islam bring to mind. They said, contrary to the Disney theme song, it's not a small world after all. It's a big one, bigger than most of us ever knew. We've got a lot to learn about it. Tell us about the subject of your book, Ibn Battuta. Who was he?
Well, Ibn Battuta was a Moroccan man, and he lived in the 14th century. And as a young man, about 21 years old, he decided to go to Mecca on a pilgrimage and wound up being gone for almost 25 years and then another 5 years, almost 30 years, traveling all over the known world. And when he got back, he dictated his travels to a court secretary who wrote it all down, and that was passed on to all of us in the 21st century.
So here he was in the tradition maybe of Marco Polo, Christopher Columbus,
exactly.
Ibn Battuta, a name not a household word in America.
Not yet, I suppose.
Not yet, but it's getting there right now. It's a beautiful book, and the swirl of Arabic language and Arabic motifs and scenes from desert and mosque are really just gorgeous. I'd love it if you'd read a passage for us. I think you've selected a passage right at the beginning of the book to introduce us to Ibn Battuta. Please read that and tell us about the illustration that goes with it.
Okay. Well, I will tell you about the illustration first because we see him looking at a large map. His father is sitting beside him and his mother is sitting on the other side. And the map is of the world at that time. There's just Europe, Asia, and Africa. And I chose that picture, decided to draw it, because as a boy, I liked looking at maps, and I know a lot of kids do. So let me read you from the opening pages.
from James Rumford's Traveling Man.
Yeah. At the edge of the world, in the days when the earth was flat and Jerusalem was the center of the world, there was a boy named Ibn Battuta. Ibn Battuta lived on the very edge of the world, near the shores of the Ocean of Darkness. Nothing but night lay to the west, but to the east lay the golden world, and he dreamed of traveling across it. On maps, he would trace his finger along scarlet roads to reach the vermilion stars that marked the great cities of the world. And on hot afternoons, in an imaginary boat, he would cross cool, peacock-colored seas to the eastern edge of the earth and sail fearlessly into the ocean of darkness as ignorance. When he grew up, he wore the turban of a scholar, and he could recite the Quran. At 21, he decided to go to Mecca as a pilgrim. Here begins his story.
And off begins
from there.
Quite incredible journey that goes all the way from Tangiers, all the way in western North Africa, across the deserts, across the Middle East, into India and China. It's quite a story. Listeners, you can see some illustrations from James Rumford's Traveling Man and also some of the text at our website, www.wbur.org. Click on Special Coverage, and it's there. And it is gorgeous, brings the region wonderfully to mind. James Rumford, when Ibn Battuta was traveling in this vast swath of the world, it was mainly an Islamic world he was traveling through.
Right. In going from Morocco all the way to China, he never felt, I think, out of touch with his culture. There were Muslims all the way along the route, and he met them, talked about the places he stayed. It was a different world then. The world still looks like that in some ways. There is a Muslim culture, basically, from Morocco almost all the way to China. In fact, China has one of the largest populations of Muslims.
And a rapidly growing one in the United States.
Yes,
What did you want to introduce American children to about Islamic culture? What did you feel they needed to understand, to learn?
Well, when I wrote this book, my goal was to show kids or tell kids about this man that many people did not know about, but I filled it full of Arabic calligraphy because I wanted children to know what that writing looked like. And I wanted them also to know what Arabic designs look like, the kind you see on mosques, the kind you see on walls, tiled walls. I wanted to introduce children to all of that, and I filled the pages with it, hoping that by doing so, they would open up a door into a world, a new world, a bigger world, like bigger than it's a small world kind of world, and so that they would be able to understand more about the events that are happening in the world. And I wrote this before September 11th, of course, and now children are eager to learn more.
Yeah, I'm sure they are, and they'll learn beautifully here. This is a long way from religious fanaticism and violence. This goes deep into history and deep into imagery. Describe a couple of the images from the book to help bring it to people's minds.
Well, one particular image that is when he's at the center of the world in Jerusalem, as all maps were made in those days, with Jerusalem in the very center. Mm-hmm. On that page, I have on one side the red desert that surrounds all that part of the world and on the way to Mecca. But on the opposite side, I have Ibn Battuta standing in front of the Dome of the Rock, which is the shrine in Jerusalem. But surrounding him is Arabic calligraphy in white on blue, as it is on mosques. And in this, these are his own words about how he tells a man how much he loves traveling.
James Rumford, hang on to that thought. We have to take a break for just a moment. We're talking about Islam in children's literature with James Rumford, author of Traveling Man, The Journey of Ibn Battuta. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Or get into the conversation online at wbur.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. Here's the question. What do you want your children to know about the world, about Islam now? What are you reading your children? And has reading to your children helped you through this strange season? I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston.
from Boston University.
This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about Islam in children's literature. It's a gloomy world out there and a frightening world sometimes lately, but there's a lot to learn, and the more we know, the clearer things get. We're talking right now with James Rumford. He's author of Traveling Man. It's a story about an Islamic traveler in the mold of Marco Polo and Christopher Columbus, who traveled widely in the world, 600-700 years ago, James Rumford?
Yes, quite a long time ago for us now, and the world is quite a different place, except I think some things are the same.
Here's the question. What are your children asking you about Islam? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. And Jim Rumford, I'm sorry to have interrupted you. You were about to read to us, and we'd love to hear more.
Sure. Let me pick a passage. Here he is in Africa. And when he goes down to Africa, he's already been gone from home for 5 years. And on this page, you see him having tea with an African sultan. And the African sultan is petting a leopard. And surrounding them are stars, which turn into bubbles in an ocean filled with tropical fish, running alongside an African continent of gazelles, gold gazelles leaping. And here's what I wrote about his part of the travels at that time. South to Zanj. Now, Zanj was the name of that part of Africa, Eastern Africa, Zanzibar today. Hot, salty waves crashed into the ship. At first I was terrified, but slowly I learned to love the sea. We sailed down the coast of ivory and ebony, of gold dust and leopard skins. I could find no words to describe the beauty I saw. Everywhere I went, sultans asked me about my home and about my travels. Under warm African stars, I found the words I needed and told them all I could. Traveling, it leaves you speechless, then turns you into a storyteller. And from there, he goes on to India and into China.
He writes about the thing that all travelers come to understand, that you're a stranger on the road, and then stay away long enough, you're a stranger when you come home as well.
Yeah, he found that out after 25, 30 years on the road.
James,
he realized.
Yeah, I'm sorry. You've experienced some of that yourself among many other travels. You were in the Peace Corps in Afghanistan. When was that, and what was that like?
I was in the Peace Corps in Afghanistan in 1974-75. That was right after the overthrow of the king, and there was a prime minister. It was a time, I think, of liberal attitudes in Afghanistan. It was a time just before the Russians invaded. It was a time of peace, and so when I look at Afghanistan today and see it on the newsreels, I can recognize some of the streets, but I don't know anything else about it. The trees are gone, the buildings are gone, and it looks completely devastated.
There's an image from centuries ago that lives on in your book. You've done some readings since September 11th from your book. What's that been like, delivering this to American schoolchildren?
It's been interesting. When I show them the picture in the book and I tell them that I drew it from memory, a picture of Afghanistan, a snow-covered mountains and a caravan crossing it, sometimes the children say they're very interested and they stand up and they say, oh. But recently, and what was more disturbing, was that a group of children, third graders, started booing when I told them that this was Afghanistan. And then when I told them I had lived there, there was even more disapproval. And I looked at the teachers and winked and I said, we have time to teach now. This is the point where we're going to tell them something. So we tried. And I think we kind of helped.
Minds can be open to hatred or understanding, I guess, by the same events.
But with this book, which is just a totally an amazing thing to me, it's just a story about a traveler, but it's a point of departure, I think, for understanding the events in this world.
Understanding what a spectacular world it has been, and we hope can be again. James Rumford, stand by. Mm-hmm. I want to bring in Kefra Burns right now. He joins us from Atlanta. He's the author of another new children's book with an Islamic theme entitled Mansa Musa. Welcome, Kefra Burns.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for being with us. Tell us a little bit about the story that you convey in Mansa Musa.
Well, the
the departure point, I guess, was there's a fragment. There's a little bit of history about Manzi Musa, the king, as a grown man. He was pretty renowned because he led a camel caravan across the Sahara to Egypt and then on to Mecca back in the 13th century.
And this was the king of Mali at a time that Mali was extremely powerful and wealthy.
Extremely powerful, yes. 60,000 courtiers laden with gold bars and gold dust, so much gold that the price of gold on the Egyptian stock market, I guess you would say, crashed for a decade.
He was a disaster for the Egyptian gold market.
He gave away so much gold. He was known even in medieval Europe, where they drew maps of Africa and had a portrait of Manzi Musa. They thought he was the king of the entire continent. But on his return, he brought back scholars from all over the world, from Andalusia, even Es-Sahili was an Andalusian, mm-hmm. and built Timbuktu into the intellectual and commercial center of the world at that time.
And a name that still reverberates today. Kefren Burns, we'd love it if you'd read us a little bit of Manzi Musa.
Well, Manzi Musa, this story is about Manzi Musa as a little boy, mm-hmm. kidnapped from his village by slave traders and then rescued by a Tuareg mystic named Tariq. And they wander the desert for several years, learning about life. And at some point, about 5 years into their travels, they come across ancient Egypt. It was known as Alkemia. And the capital city, Al-Kaira, which is where we get the word Cairo mm-hmm. from. Mm-hmm. And so after wandering in solitude in the desert, he comes in. There's traders and vendors and merchants and just so much activity. It's really astounding in ancient Egypt.
Take us into it.
Okay. Kankan Musa had never seen such intense activity. In Al-Kaira, he met people from the far corners of the world. Many were black, but there were some whose skins were the color of copper or amber, and some who were the color of old ivory. They came from the Mediterranean and beyond, from Greece and Rome, and from farther east of Alkemia. They were Muslims, Christians, and Jews. Alkemia was a land of many prophets, Kankan discovered, and some were shared by Muslims, Christians, and Jews alike. One such prophet, he learned, was known by a name that is the same as Musa. In our tongue, you would be known as Kankan Moses, said one old woman of the Nile. It means unfathered son of a princess. Kankan felt the familiar sting, the unfulfilled longing to know his own father. But he listened, and the old woman continued. It also means drawn out of water, she said. As in ancient times, the infant Moses was found floating in a basket in the Nile. Moses didn't know his father, but in time he learned the truth about his own identity and later led his people into the desert and onto the path, the siyahat of self-discovery. It is the same everywhere, Kankan remarked that night as he and Tariq supped on lamb, dates, and sun-raised bread in a small inn. Whether man, woman, or nation, we are born into the world, and once born, must set out on a journey of discovery to discover just who we are and where we have come from.
That's Kefra Burns reading from his beautiful book, Manzi Musa, describing the travels and rise to power of a young man in long-ago Mali. We're talking about Islam in children's literature tonight. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. What do you want your children to know about the world, about Islam now? What are you reading your children in this strange, strange season? Kefra Burns, what do you think it's important for American children to understand about Islam now, post-September 11th?
Well, I think what I tried to communicate in this book, not only about Islam, but about various cultures, mm-hmm. Is the same as my wife and I. We have a book called Confirmation, the Spiritual Wisdom that Shaped Our Lives. Mm-hmm. And it's inspirational writings from all of the diverse religious traditions all over the world. And the point is that beneath the sectarian doctrine, the dogma, and the peculiarities or the particularities of the different cultures and language, everybody is saying the same thing. It's the same thing. Whether Allah is only an Arabic word for God, it's not anything different than, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, they would say that God is an English word for Allah, but they're both talking about the same principle, the same divine being. And so I think what happens is that kids pick up the prejudices of their parents, and the prejudices are based on ignorance, a lack of exposure. You know, we fear that which is unknown, that which we don't understand. But once you are exposed and you become familiar with anything, it becomes less fearful, you know, less frightening.
Well, you've certainly conveyed an inviting book in Mansa Musa. Kefra Burns, thanks very much for joining us this evening.
Thank you for having me.
Kefra Burns is author of Mansa Musa. James Rumford, I'll put the same question to you. What do you think is most important for American children to understand about Islam right now?
I feel the same. The answer that Kefra Burns gave, I wholeheartedly agree with. I think that we have to see the similarities, and before we start emphasizing the differences. And I think in looking and seeing that in the sense that God and Allah can equate the same thing, I think that's a starting point. And when we look at the art and we look at the civilization, the literature, these are also starting points for showing how close together we all are.
I want to bring in another author right now. We're joined by Deborah Ellis. She's author of The Breadwinner. Deborah Ellis has been an anti-war activist. She's done work with Afghan women, was in refugee camps in Pakistan to do a book on adult women, and decided to write this children's book. Since September 11th, more than 10,000 copies have been reprinted. There's a sudden surge of interest. We're happy to welcome you. Deborah Ellis, good evening.
Hello.
Thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
Please tell us a little bit about The Breadwinner. This is, we've talked about two books that are absolutely gorgeous, illustrated books. This is for a slightly older reader. It looks to me like maybe a 10-year-old, correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, 8 to 9 or 10 or 13,
okay.
That kind of age.
And this is a tougher story. This is set right in the middle of where news is being made today, in Afghanistan. The Taliban is all through your book. Tell us the story of The Breadwinner.
When I was in Pakistan interviewing women, I met a woman whose daughter was back in Kabul and who had cut off her hair and was masquerading as a boy in order to earn a living for the family because there was no male breadwinner. And as soon as I heard that story, I knew that I would write it up as a children's novel because it's such a compelling tale of courage in the face of horrible circumstances. So it's based on a true story, but everything that happens in the book has taken place in Afghanistan since the Taliban took over.
We've got a passage here we'd like you to read, and I have to forewarn our listeners that it's a little rough. This is not just exotic wonderment. This is a tough environment in which a young girl disguised as a boy is eking out a living in very hard and frightening circumstances. Could you read for us on page 106, Deborah Ellis?
Sure. I'll just set it up for a minute. One of the ways that Parvana, the main character, and her friend Shazia, who is also masquerading as a boy, want to earn a living is they find that someone will pay them if they would dig up bones, human bones, in the graveyard. So I'll start from there. The two girls looked at each other, each hoping the other would make the first move. "We're here to make money, right?" Shazia said. Parvana nodded. "Well, then, let's make money." She grabbed hold of the bone that was sticking out of the ground and pulled. It came out of the dirt as if it were a carrot being pulled up from a garden. Shazia tossed it on the blanket. Not willing to let Shazia get the better of her, Parvana took up her board and started scraping away the soil. The bombs had done much of the work for them. Many bones were barely covered by dirt and were easy to get at. A few minutes later, Parvana unearthed a skull. "Hey, look at this." She used the board to loosen the ground around it, then dug the rest of it up with her fingers so she wouldn't break it. She held it up to Shazia as though it were a trophy. "It's grinning." "Of course it's grinning. He's glad to be out in the sunshine after being in the dark ground for so long. Aren't you glad, Mr. Skull?" She made the skull nod. "See, I told you. Prop him up on the gravestone. He'll be our mascot." Parvana placed him carefully on the broken headstone. "He'll be like our boss, watching us to make sure we do it right." They cleaned out the first grave and moved on to the next, taking Mr. Skull with them. He was joined in a little while by another skull. By the time their blanket was full of bones, there were five skulls perched in a row, grinning down at the girls.
Author Deborah Ellis, reading from her children's book, The Breadwinner, set in a very troubled Afghanistan. Deborah Ellis, this is a very different environment. This is not golden-toned exotica from centuries long past. This is a tough life in Afghanistan right now, and Afghanistan dominated by the Taliban, Islamic extremists. What sense or what are you trying to convey to American children about that face of Islam?
I'm not trying to convey anything about Islam. I'm certainly far from being qualified to even begin to do that.
Mm-hmm.
What I am trying to convey is what the environment of war is, and that war does not simply stop when the bombs stop dropping, that war continues on and on and on, and it has incredible ramifications for a country, such as the chaos that it leaves behind, the landmines that it leaves behind, the destruction of the economic structure of the country gets totally destroyed in a war. And I wanted to show how people have to try to live and have dignity within that, especially children.
Very difficult to do. But you don't pull any punches on what women have suffered in Afghanistan.
No, I certainly tried not to. There are a lot of very difficult scenes in the book of women being imprisoned and beaten and so forth. But I also tried to portray a lot of the Afghan people who are around these children as being very kind and caretaking, because that's the way most of the people there are.
James Rumford, jump in here with us. We just got a minute before the break, but how are, well, adults or children either for that matter, to make sense of this kind of clash of wondrous images in your sumptuously illustrated book and then this horror of war and devastation in Afghanistan today and anger we see from much of the Islamic world? How do you put it all together?
It's very difficult. I think that the art side of it in my book is one aspect of the culture. And certainly the Taliban, this is an aberration, and from my point of view. And I think that children need to know about that to make sense of what's going on in Afghanistan. And I think that Deborah Ellis has done a great job of doing that. And then after that book, I would like them to turn to some of the other books that are out there that show about the greatness of this civilization and let them make up their own decisions. Let them make up their own minds. Maybe they'll have enough information then.
As children will and do. We're talking this hour about children's literature that illuminates the world of Islam. We're joined by James Rumford, author and illustrator of Traveling Man, The Journey of Ibn Battuta, and Deborah Ellis, author of The Breadwinner. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Has reading to your children helped you through this fall? What are your children asking you about Islam? You can read excerpts and check out illustrations from these books. They're on our website, log on WBUR.org, and click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about the world of Islam in children's literature. We're joined by James Rumford. He's author and illustrator of Traveling Man, The Journey of Ibn Battuta, and by Deborah Ellis, author of The Breadwinner, a tough story about a girl in Afghanistan disguising herself as a boy so that she can go out into Taliban-ruled Kabul and make a living for her family. It's all about children and how they understand what's going on in the world right now. What do you want your children to know about the world, about Islam now? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Deborah Ellis, tell us a little more about your experience in the refugee camps where you ran into and met many Afghans. And then, if you would, give us another scene or two that those experiences inspired in your book, The Breadwinner.
Well, I think the overwhelming emotion in the refugee camps was one of hopelessness. These people have, in some cases, been there for 15 years and waiting for things that they don't even know what they're waiting for anymore. Maybe the situation will improve, but often it doesn't. Also, there's, of course, incredible poverty and despair. I saw a lot of grown-ups who had simply given up and who were basically sitting in small balls in their tents or in their homes. But I also saw many, many moments of grace of people helping each other and offering to be hosts for people when they didn't have anything for themselves. So all of those things happened in the camps.
Heroine, I guess, of your book is Parvana, if I pronounce that correctly.
That's right, yeah.
And she has many scrapes with Taliban authorities in Kabul.
Mm-hmm.
Give us an outline of one or two of those. What kind of troubles she faces trying to live?
Well, a lot of the things that she faces are not simply because she's masquerading as a boy, but simply because the Taliban are so were so strict and so medieval in the way they ran the country. For example, her father was arrested simply because he had a foreign education, and when she and her mother go to the prison to try to get him released, they are beaten by the Taliban soldiers guarding the prison because they're not supposed to be outside their home. Those kinds of things. They have to remain inside. Her older sister hasn't been outside the house for over a year. They haven't been in school. All of those kinds of things that they're having to face. And there's a scene in the book where Parvana and Shazia go to the sports stadium. They now have, they're selling objects off of a tray, and they think that in the stadium people will be watching the soccer game and will want to smoke and chew gum and so forth. And but, of course, what they see in the stadium is much different from a soccer game.
You're referring there to the punishment of Afghan women for breaking the Taliban's laws.
That's right, and amputations of people accused of theft and those kinds of things.
It's a tough, tough book. How would you expect a young American boy or girl to read that, and what would they take away from it?
Well, I wrote it very much with the Western audience in mind. I thought it was important that kids over here know what's happening over there.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that they take away from it a sense of awe of the courage that children in other parts of the world have just in order to keep alive. Also, I hope they take away from it a sense of hope, because there are many, many acts of kindness throughout the book, even in the midst of the terror that the children are facing. And I also hope that they take away from it some kind of sense in the back of their mind that these are human beings, exactly the same as we are. Parvana has the same kinds of arguments with her older sister that kids here have with their siblings. And because they're human beings, they need to be treated with dignity. And when the kids who read the book now grow up and become decision makers, I hope that they realize that they can't let their governments get away with things that are going to hurt people either now or down the line.
You obviously started writing this book long before September 11th, and
yes,
things have developed dramatically, radically in Afghanistan since then. Have you thought about a sequel and what it might be?
Well, yeah, I thought long before September 11th about a sequel, and I've got one planned and just about completed, actually. The book ends with the two girls going off in very different journeys. One just decides she has to get out of Afghanistan. Her parents are planning to marry her off, and she's only like 12 or so, and she needs to just get out of there to save herself. And so she leaves the country, and Parvana heads further into it to continue to search for her family. So they choose very different paths, and so I'm following their paths.
Who knows what environment they'll have to pursue those paths into in the months and years ahead.
Yeah.
James Rumford, since September 11th, you've written a little pamphlet, a short story, illustrated in a very kind of a primitive, childlike illustration, actually about the events of September 11th. It's called Last Tuesday. Could you read that for us?
Sure. I wrote it, just a little background, because as everyone was terribly affected by all of this, and so was I. I didn't know what to do with myself. I liked the editor who was talking about, well, now what? What do we do now? And I sat down, and this came out. I'll describe the pictures a little bit. They are primitive, as you said, as though a child of maybe first grade drew them. Mommy, said the little girl with big brown eyes, I went to tell Grandma about last Tuesday, but I don't know how to write the words. The little girl pushed some pictures she had drawn in front of her mother. I want you to put words with these pictures. Please, Mommy? Her mother got out a pen. Tell Grandma this is a picture of us going to the World Trade Center last Tuesday, and you see the two of them in front of the two towers. That's the blue dress you were wearing, she said to her mother. The next page. The tower is in a close-up, and there's somebody in one of the windows. This is Daddy in his office, waiting for us to come up. The sun is shining. The next picture shows the plane going into the first tower. Here's when the first plane hit, and they wouldn't let us in the building. Next page. This is the second plane. You see one on fire and the plane going in and the fireman there. Next page. Tell her we waited, but Daddy never came down. You see her, she's drawn a picture of herself and her mother with tears coming out and the firemen and the smoke. The next page. Tell her we are sad, but okay. Mommy, I still remember how to write my name. Let me do it. Mim Ra Ya Mim. Mariam. And there on the page next to a crayon is her name written in Arabic. And that's all there is to that little book.
James Rumford reading a very short and very affecting story about September 11th called Last Tuesday in the author's version of the words and illustrations of a child who's lost her father there and who writes her name in Arabic. And she is, we imagine, a Muslim child.
You know, I thought about that. I thought about all of the Muslim children, all the people from all over the world that died that Tuesday. And I thought that that hate was not just directed toward Americans. Well, it was directed toward Americans, but collaterally a lot of other people died from other places.
It must
and
be.
And I just wanted to, if I might, Deborah Ellis said about the sequel to her book, you know, last year in California, two Afghan girls came up to me. I would think they're like Parwana and this other girl. And I had just the rough draft of Traveling Man. They asked if I could read the writing on the pages, and I said I could. I said, can you? And they said, yes, we can. And I said, where are you from? And they said, from Afghanistan. And then I began to speak to them in Afghan Persian. And the one girl burst into tears. And I guess after hearing what Deborah Ellis said, I understand a little bit more why she would. That here in America was somebody who could understand her culture a little bit, but it also brought back perhaps horrible, horrible memories of a life that she had to live, maybe without her parents.
James Rumford, you've illustrated this world so wonderfully in your book, Traveling Man, including Afghanistan, it's a lovely illustration. It's got a map in the background and a camel caravan and the mountains of the Hindu Kush. And it's all so sumptuous and all so inviting and exotic. And now this has happened. And I wonder, do you feel betrayed somehow by the world that you presented so marvelously?
That's a very good question. When the morning after September 11th, I thought, what is my book about? What good is it going to do? As you say, it is a sumptuous, exotic, gold-filled and everything else. And then I thought when children came to me and after looking at it, or adults, and they said, well, maybe this is what we need to focus on. Not only the horror, only the things that have happened, but this aspect of the world. It's still a beautiful world, and it has a long, rich history, and this is a tiny, tiny part of it.
Maybe that brings some balance into our world. James Rumford, I want to thank you for being with us this hour from Hawaii.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
James Rumford is author and illustrator of Traveling Man, The Journey of Ibn Battuta. And Deborah Ellis, thank you as well for joining us.
Thank you.
Deborah Ellis is author of The Breadwinner. You can read excerpts and check out illustrations from our guest books tonight. They're on our website at wbur.org. Click under Special Coverage. At the end of the Gulf War, after Baghdad's troops deserted Kuwait, the Kuwaitis found many documents which were abandoned by the Iraqi military. Among them was the diary of a young Iraqi lieutenant. Special coverage producer Ian Doherty reads excerpts from this personal account of war.
Tuesday, 15th of January, 1991. The army is in a state of total alert to prepare itself against Allied and American aggression, expected against our well-loved territory. I am very worried for my parents because I know what these conditions represent for them. But God is good. We wish the war had not happened, but it has. So combat will be welcome. Tuesday, 17th of January, 1991. Say this, all that happens is what God has decided for us. God has spoken truly. This morning at 2:45 a.m. I heard military aircraft. A few seconds later, the guard came in and told me in a voice tinged with caution, fear, and consternation, "Lieutenant, Lieutenant, there may be bombing." I dressed quickly and then realized that the American and Atlantic attack against our country was starting and that the war had begun. Afterwards, the enemy planes began their intensive bombing on the airfield that we have been assigned to defend at As Salman in Al Makna province. O God, protect. O God, patience. O God, save us all. 2nd of February, 1991. I was awakened this morning by the noise of an enemy air raid. I ran and hid in the nearby trench. Two enemy planes came towards us and began firing at us in turn with missiles, machine guns and rockets. I was almost killed. Death was a yard away from me. One of the rockets hit and pierced our shelter. The attack lasted about 15 minutes, but it seemed like a year to me. I read chapters in the Quran. How hard it is to be killed by someone you don't know, you've never seen and can't confront. He is in the sky and you're on the ground. Friday, 15th of February, 1991. I went to a field hospital because I was very ill. I heard that Iraq has decided to withdraw from Kuwait. Saturday, 16th of February, 1991. I feel so fatigued that I can't breathe, and I think I am going to faint at any moment from my illness. The only thing that you can find everywhere in the world is air, and yet I can't breathe it. I can't breathe, eat, drink, or talk. I have been here for 39 days and have not yet gone on leave. The planes came and bombed battalion headquarters. Most of the positions were destroyed, and three soldiers were killed. When the planes came to bomb us, I remained standing because I can't go into the trench. Sunday, 17th of February, 1991. My illness is getting worse. I am short of breath. I hurt. I have begun taking medicine. I don't know what it's for, but the main thing is to take it because I know the medicine can't cause me any more pain than I'm already enduring. The air raids have started up again.
That was the diary of an Iraqi soldier found after the Gulf War. Transcripts of the radio diaries featured on our special coverage are now available on our website. Log on to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage. If you have a radio diary you'd like us to air, send it to special@wbur.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston.